The bright green grassy field would not be covered for the show until the following morning, and the band worked out for 2 hours in the fading afternoon light before an empty stadium. That night, the musicians kept to themselves, although if you looked quickly, you could have caught Phil Lesh and his party having drinks in the lobby of the Ritz-Carlton, band headquarters for the weekend. On Friday, the stadium opened the lots at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, 4 hours earlier than they would for tailgating before a Bears game, after rejecting a petition signed by 11,000 deadheads asking to allow overnight camping. Shapiro installed tables for select nonprofits in what he called Participation Row, and other authorized vendors found key spots. Kreutzmann was furious to learn the artwork his associates planned to sell had been soaked by late-night automatic sprinklers inside their tent. Next door, Jerry Garcia's art dealers had erected a small wood building and readied to do land office business. As at Levi's, the parking lot scene was hardly the robust carnival from days of yore, but people were meeting who hadn't seen each other in years. Police averted their gaze as vendors doled out various cannabis edibles. One gentleman openly sold balloons filled with nitrous oxide from a tank. All afternoon, deadheads moved like a herd through the park to the stadium. At every downtown traffic light, a cluster waited to cross. Hippies stood all the way, holding up one finger for a miracle ticket. The fragrance of burning marijuana was everywhere. The tribe was gathering, coming together in the Lakeshore Park as they walked to the stadium, past Mouse's banners hanging on the front of the Field Museum. As joyful and loving as Santa Clara had been, the Chicago tribe went far beyond that. They had come from all over the country, taken over Chicago as an invading force for the weekend, and transformed the city for their own purposes. At Soldier Field, security barely checked the crowd while they flooded into the refurbished old football stadium. Shapiro dressed personnel in tie-dye, and, once again, handed out 50,000 roses, along with printed programs. More than three-quarters of the audience had traveled from out of state. While there were plenty of gray ponytails in the house, more than half the crowd wasn't old enough to have seen Garcia play. The festive audience of more than 70,000 broke the attendance record set by U2 in 2009. Fare Thee Well had struck a chord. The concert attracted interest far beyond the commercial appeal of the surviving Dead members in any previous incarnation. Whatever convergence of synchronicity and thinking had transpired to create this enormous cultural moment, it had worked. If there is such a thing as a collective unconscious, it was certainly operating here. The air at Soldier Field was heavy with emotion, rich with consumer satisfaction, before one note of music had been played. These people had come to a historic occasion, and they knew it. It was the passing of an era, and they were not going to let it pass without them. The VIP guests included Deadhead Senator Al Franken, who had also attended Levi's, and Game of Thrones author George R.R. Martin. John Mayer knew he wouldn't be invited to play, so he brought his girlfriend, Katy Perry. The pop star couple attracted a lot of attention as unlikely backstagers, since word about the new band they were going to call Dead & Company hadn't really filtered out. Chicago homeboy Bill Murray was on hand, hanging out with the Los Angeles alt-rock singer-songwriter Jenny Lewis. The rock world was well represented, with Perry Farrell of Jane's Addiction, John Popper of Blues Traveler, Liz Phair, members of Phish, Disco Biscuits, Wilco, The National, Moe. Actor Woody Harrelson and actress Chloe Sevigny attended, as did Indianapolis Colts owner Jim Irsay, who owned Wolf, one of Garcia's Doug Irwin guitars. The friends and family section was crowded with old Dead family members. Mountain Girl was there with all three of her daughters, dropping a little acid for that old-time feeling. Second-generation Dead children were everywhere. Not just the Garcia girls, but a passel of young adults who had grown up together backstage, many of them with children of their own. Somebody brought a jar containing Owsley Stanley's ashes and placed it on the soundboard. Backstage, once again, the dressing rooms were divided, with Lesh on one side and the others in the opposite direction. Lesh's accommodations were not only larger than the pipe and drape-covered locker rooms the others used, but came with a private bathroom. A lengthy afternoon soundcheck also provided another undercover rehearsal, but sapped the musicians before the show. The mood backstage, while not grim, was businesslike. Weir toyed with his guitar quietly in the corner, wearing his serious man-at-work face. Kreutzmann took a few minutes to pose for family photos and cut a birthday cake for his grandson, but otherwise stayed alone and solemn in his private sanctum. The men from the dead couldn't escape the weight of the great expectations that awaited them. As the band mounted the stage, the four men knew this was where it all ends. All the struggles, all the heartbreak, all the broken alliances and mended fences no longer mattered. They did what they needed to do to get them to this point. The music would take them the rest of the way now. They would start where they left off, singing Box of Rain, Lesh's best-known song for the dead, which ended the last Soldier Field concert exactly 6 days short of 20 years before. Whatever powerful emotional weight that might have carried was destroyed almost as soon as Lesh opened his mouth to sing. All the Phil and Friends shows had not turned Lesh into a lead vocalist. The band charged into the song, but Lesh's feeble, strained vocal couldn't match the power of the band. In the record industry, they would say he couldn't sing up to the tracks. He worked his way weakly through the song, hardly the striking, penetrating moment needed to open the show. On Jack Straw, Weir took control and slowed the drive into the song down to a syrupy crawl. After some less successful passages, they brought the piece to a substantial finish. Anastasio's first lead vocal, the surefire Bertha, got better almost line by line. Not only was this the first time he had ever sung it in public, he was doing it in front of a jam-packed football stadium. His guitar solo was more confident. By the end, he was winning everybody over, on the bandstand and off. Up next, Passenger from the Terrapin Station album was never more than modest repertoire, even when the band played the song occasionally during the late 70s and early 80s. Not some neglected gem, but the band found a nice groove to work. The Wheel, ostensibly an opportunity for Anastasio to stretch out and shine, would have foundered entirely, except for Weir's prodding but elastic rhythm guitar. Weir led the band directly into a painfully slow, almost unsteady Crazy Fingers. Even though Anastasio delivered the scrupulous lead vocal, Weir was driving the train. Halfway through the first set at Chicago, the limitations of the band's ability to recreate the authentic Grateful Dead experience without Garcia were already obvious, but that was also beside the point to everybody who was there. Weir dug into The Music Never Stopped with the conviction of someone who was under a spell. He was possessed. Weir and Anastasio tangled their guitars to the close, driving the band to a fierce end of the first set. Lesh opened the second set with Mason's Children, a track left off Working Man's Dead, and performed by the band only a dozen or so times in 1969 to 1970, that had been a piece of archaeology extensively excavated by Phil and Friends, another number that hardly qualified as a lost classic. Anastasio handled Scarlet Begonias, his confidence clearly growing set by set, and Hornsby took the reggae-fied Fire on the Mountain, the band gelling as they went into the evening's drums space segment. The space jam led to the complex Lesh psychedelic nugget, New Potato Caboose, which the Dead stopped playing in 1969. The band dissolved into lengthy jamming through a surprisingly tepid Playing in the Band, where the musicians lost the plot, going out too far in the zone. Let It Grow, with Weir overamping the vocals again, and into the 80s vintage beloved medley, Help on the way, Slipknot, Franklin's Tower. Anastasio muttered sorry after fluffing some lyrics, but the band built toward a credible climax. Hornsby, who had not been well-versed in the Dead's 60s psychedelic catalog since the band largely avoided that material during his stint, felt right at home swimming in this stream. As he looked across the stage and experienced this palpable sense of power growing, watching everyone on stage, feeling himself rocking the house, he knew this was what he came for, and took pause to cherish the moment. He turned and took in the vast crowd, swept with spotlights, dancing and weaving like a roiling sea, and was almost overwhelmed by the whole scene. He knew it would not come again anytime soon. Lesh returned for his donor rap. "Nobody up here had any idea what response we would get," he told the crowd. "It is stunning to see and experience the love we have for each other." The band encored with a supple ripple, Weir allowing himself a satisfied smile as he slowed down the tempo even more, heading into the final verse and chorus, and sent the crowd out into the warm Chicago night, humming and buzzing. It may not have been the epic Grateful Dead performance, but the show was not without searing high points and rich emotionalism. Weir poured himself into the music, and Lesh, at age 75, showed incredible stamina, barreling through a four-hour show and two-hour soundcheck like a man half his age. Roger McNamee missed the first show in Chicago. His band Moon Alice had been booked to play after the pay-per-view broadcast on Friday at Mill Valley Sweetwater, the club Weir helped create. He pulled together his party, including Moon Alice guitarist Barry Sless and equipment manager Steve Parrish. Parrish, whose son attended medical school in Chicago, agreed to go on only reluctantly. At least he could visit his kid. They flew into Chicago on Saturday. On the flight, Parrish, hardly a shrinking violet, complained loudly about his discomfort. He didn't want to go. He was unhappy with the whole deal and convinced he would not be welcome. Cameron Sears also felt weird about attending. He had managed the Grateful Dead through a procession of stadium tours in the 80s and 90s and had not been part of the scene after getting kicked to the curb by Weir when he and Lesh started further. Sears had taken a job as executive director of the Rex Foundation, the philanthropic concern founded and initially funded by the Dead, but surviving as an independent charity after Garcia's death. Shapiro gave Rex a slot in the participation row, and Sears had manned the table at two Santa Clara shows, which he had not enjoyed. It was too weird, standing outside the squeaky clean, soulless stadium, handing out pamphlets, when he was accustomed to working backstage, supervising the crew, arranging a thousand details, and being in the center of the action. He had not been especially inspired by the music he heard, so Sears also went to Chicago without any high expectations. But Chicago turned out to be an entirely different experience for Sears. This was a special occasion beyond the scope of the Levi's stadium shows. He was thronged at his table by old friends he hadn't seen in years. The happy crowd refreshed his recollection of how wonderful Deadheads could be and how powerful their sense of community truly was. He was bowled over, and watching the band, found the spirit of the crowd imbued the concert with such joy, the quality of the music no longer mattered. That night, he got on the phone to his wife, Cassidy, who was on vacation with their two teenage children in Massachusetts, and convinced her to book tickets and fly in for the last show on Sunday. The 4th of July, on a Saturday, and a Grateful Dead concert in the park, all downtown Chicago had been turned into Dead Town, thrumming with the glow from the last night show. Some deadhead picked up David Ganza's breakfast tab at a downtown restaurant because he recognized the broadcaster's voice from his satellite radio Grateful Dead show. Ganz and his business partner, Gary Lambert, were doing three-hour preview shows from a booth in the lot and color commentary at set break from the Chicago Bears broadcast booth above the 50-yard line to accompany the live broadcast on Sirius XM, delayed 1 hour to preserve the video pay-per-view exclusivity. Gans and Lambert had been astonished at how much fun they had had with what could have been a bothersome, boring task. Like everybody else, nothing prepared them for the overwhelming good feelings of the weekend. Everybody knew the circus was in town by the second show. An airplane circled downtown, trailing a sign reading, "Grateful Forever." The DirecTV blimp floated above the stadium, flashing dancing bears on its video display. For the second time, they broke the U2 attendance record at Soldier Field. After the brief soundcheck, Phil and Jill Lesh, like Kreutzmann at Santa Clara, took a golf cart out to tour the lots. Like visiting royalty, they took their star turn, with Jill behind the wheel waving to the deadheads, the exclusive fare-thee-well photographer Jay Blakesburg capturing it all on video. Band members rarely ventured into the lots before. Someone took Weir on a quick ride through one of the lots during the 90s, and the scene was burned into his brain. They largely averted their eyes from the grimy subculture beyond the gates, especially after the crowds outside the concert grew larger than those inside and caused enormous problems with various civic authorities. The band hated these mob scenes, but Shapiro had fashioned a safer, carefully filtered version of the old parking lots for Fare Thee Well, a modest, curated facsimile of the sprawling underground market that sprung up around Grateful Dead concerts. Neither Lesh nor any of the Dead would have ventured into those original dens of iniquity. In the intervening years, however, the musicians had grown more respectful of the genuine bond between the Deadheads, and the band had come to better understand the nature of the community that grew around their often insular enterprise. What was happening at Chicago was, for once, the band returning the respect showed them by the Deadheads. These forays by band members into the crowd at Fare Thee Well acknowledged the relationship from this new perspective. The mood in Chicago was just that contagious. In a sense, the psychedelic extravaganza of the previous night's set list came from Lesh, just as the first night at Levi's had been his. But tonight, as with the second show in Santa Clara, it was all Bobby Weir. Everybody's fingerprints were on all the set lists, but switching off, as they had in further, Weir and Lesh were the basic architects of the first four shows. The finale was a thoroughly contemplated collaboration, but the penultimate Saturday concert would be on Weir. He gave his traditional guitar bow to the audience and counted the band into a deliberate shakedown street, Weir singing hard over the funky rhythm, Anastasio burnishing the extended final chorus with tasty counterpoint run through an envelope filter, a piece of gear popularized by funk bassist Bootsy Collins, but later adapted by Garcia for one of his signature sounds. Lesh came out of the gate thunderous, and Weir was shouting over the band by the second verse. Given that it was the 4th of July, playing Liberty next made perfect sense in the context, although the song is not especially patriotic. Taken from an old Robert Hunter solo album and reworked by Garcia, the number found its way into the band shows during the 90s and was scheduled for inclusion on the unfinished final album. Weir led the stomping version defiantly, soul shouting his way to the end. Anastasio carefully, gamely picked his way through Standing on the Moon, a piece that sorely missed the ethereal delicacy of Garcia. In relatively short order for this group, the band rattled off Me and My Uncle, Tennessee Jed, and Cumberland Blues, the first song to be repeated from the Santa Clara shows. Weir took out the bottleneck for a deathly slow blues, Little Red Rooster, but it was Chimenti on organ who took over the song for a rousing, full-throated solo that drew loud cheers. The crowd could be forgiven for failing to notice the band even had an organ player, considering the absence in the sound mix of both Chimenti and Hornsby on grand piano. They were tucked away on stage in the far corner like two little boys, quietly seeing what they could get away with. Stepping up for his first vocal, Lesh ambled awkwardly through Friend of the Devil, effectively undermining one of the band's key songs. Weir can sing it like a master, but due to the politics of the Fare Thee Well process, Lesh ended up doing this crucial song in Chicago, despite efforts to limit the number of songs he sang. Lesh and his wife were alone in their appreciation of his vocal skills. The set slowed to a low point. Without waiting for Weir to count the band in, Anastasio kicked off Deal at a decidedly jaunty tempo he learned from a Jerry Garcia band version. Before Weir could do anything about it, he was off to the races. Anastasio made his way through the vocal well enough, but then lit up the instrumental break with a sprightly, dancing, silvery guitar solo. Hornsby took the second verse as the band continued to gallop along the first charging up-tempo drive of the day. The stadium came to life. For the past three shows, Anastasio stayed in the shadows, following everybody else's lead. But out of nowhere, without even thinking about it, he took the reins of this band and led them into a blasting, rocking, cathartic close to the first set. Although Weir managed to slow it down on the final chorus, it was too late. As the crowd cheered madly, Anastasio skipped off stage to catch up with Weir, slipped his arm over Weir's shoulder as they walked backstage for the set break, and asked if everything was all right. "Cool," said Weir. Lesh opened the second set with the slow, rolling groove of Bird Song, Hunter and Garcia's song written after the death of Janis Joplin. "All I know is something like a bird within her," sang. Although Lesh changed the pronoun to the masculine. Anastasio riffed lightly over Weir's jazzy chord inversions, and Hornsby kept a steady stream of piano tinkling through the jam. An organ swirl from Chimenti, Shades of Pigpen, announced Golden Road to Unlimited Devotion, a jaunty piece of long-lost Grateful Dead garage rock straight from the summer of love. The crowd leaped into action. The band charged through the song, Hornsby and Anastasio leading the vocal chorus, and then lost their way in a long, pointless jam. Weir slowed down the introduction to Lost Sailor while he was playing it, and followed with one of his most mesmerizing vocal performances in the concert so far. Going straight into Saint of Circumstance, Weir reprised the pairing of these two songs written by Weir with his lyricist John Perry Barlow, common to Dead shows of the early 80s. Hornsby took the plodding West LA fadeaway. The band picked up and worked over a riff they came up with during the previous night's playing in the band, with Chimenti and Hornsby driving the song to a satisfying close on keyboards. Anastasio essayed Foolish Heart, a latter area Hunter Garcia gem from the Built to Last album, the group's final studio album. They tucked a stinging, productive jam on the end. The band was now playing tight and confident, really swinging, that led into the space jam portion of the program. Coming out of the cloud of sound, Weir tried to nudge his compatriots into Stella Blue a couple of times before they finally followed his lead. Singing in the original Garcia key, Weir struggled with one of the most poignant songs in the Dead songbook, slowing it down for maximum narrative effect. He put everything he had into each line, like a sculptor chiseling the song, lyric by lyric. Of course, one more Saturday night brought the set to a frothy, rollicking end. Lesh came back. 50 years ago, a good friend of mine made me an offer I couldn't refuse, he said. He gave me a life I couldn't have imagined. What a long, strange trip it's been. Since it was not only Saturday night, but the 4th of July, the band returning to encore with U.S. Blues came as no surprise. Weir was game, but his voice was shredded from shouting all night over the powerful machine behind him. As the last great American rock band launched their last song of the night, outside on the Chicago skyline, red, white, and blue lights raced up and down the top of the Tribune building in tribute. When the band left the stage, fireworks filled the night sky. Chapter 23 Finale. Carol Hart was back in the hotel room with her husband after the Saturday night show, high and happy, when Jill Lesh called. They had largely avoided one another over the weekend after a brief, unpleasant encounter on the side of the stage, although Phil had been nothing but congenial with Mickey. Jill was calling Carol as her husband's representative to sternly explain that she would be taking an executive producer credit for the DVD of the concerts. Carol was offended at her tone and presumption. She knew of no reason why Jill Lesh should receive a credit on the production. The conversation didn't last long, but when Carol got off the phone, she was no longer floating on the stratospheric experience of the night. She had firmly come back to Earth. The Leshes didn't suddenly become compliant and cooperative once they agreed to do these shows. Even after all their demands had been met, down to including reading Kreutzmann's manuscript, they continued to find issues that needed to be settled. They went over the budget carefully, trimming expenses wherever they could, maximizing revenue. There would be no complimentary tickets, eliminating the guest list that could run into the hundreds at certain Grateful Dead shows. Mountain Girl ordered a batch of tickets to make sure family members who couldn't afford them would be covered. Jill was not satisfied with her husband's jumbotron time at the Levi shows, especially that there were not enough close-ups, and complained to the video director, demanding more camera time for Lesh. After Carol Hart told her outraged husband what Jill said in her Saturday night call, word spread rapidly through the rest of the band. By the morning of the final concert, everybody was pissed off at the Leshes all over again. On Saturday morning, Steve Parrish awoke and realized there was no way he would get out of going to the show. He had skipped the concert the day before, spending time with his son instead. He didn't feel good about any of this, but he had accepted McNamee's generous offer and felt obligated to his good friend. Since getting fired from Phil and Friends on the first tour, he had kept his distance from all the foolishness, although he was never lodged deeply in the heart of the Dead world. Parrish was a true believer, and has been since the day they picked him up off the sidewalk. Now he was dubious, conflicted, and unhappy, with himself and his circumstances. Parrish had never been to a Grateful Dead concert, or any concert for that matter, through the front door. He had never seen a box office or used a ticket. He had never sat in a seat in the audience. He had no idea what to expect or even what he would have to do, and it only added to his discomfort. He left for the show early with McNamee and Sless, stepping out in the warm Chicago summer to walk through the park to the stadium. Instantly, Deadheads recognized the big lummox. They approached him with respect, almost reverence, and talked to him like a cherished old friend. He wasn't two blocks away from the hotel, and every few steps, another Deadhead would stop and greet him. Parrish felt the love, and it melted his defenses. By the time he reached the stadium, he was developing a new attitude when he ran into Cameron Sears, who was heading for the Rex Foundation booth. Sears immediately recognized Parrish's confusion and shepherded him in through the box office to pick up his passes. As soon as they got inside, they encountered Mountain Girl and Carol Hart, who took over from Sears and escorted an anxious Parrish to his party backstage. Parrish was still distressed when Robbie Taylor, Lesh's stage manager, rushed to him as soon as he saw him backstage and embraced his old colleague. Parrish was suddenly surrounded by the crew, who were all ecstatic to see him. Ramrod was dead. Parrish was their last link to the glory days of the Grateful Dead road crew when they were grizzled cowboys riding the range. His presence was a touchstone to the crew that brought the spirit of the crowd backstage. Taylor took him to a special chair, placed it in Parrish's customary spot in the wings, a few feet off stage, and there he sat like the honored dignitary he was. The tough old bastard, really a softy, was humbled by the reception. This would be the final show. Whatever these four men would go on to do after this, Fare Thee Well would stand. Lesh may have thought of these shows as one giant encore, and the others may have seen the concerts as more of a portal to pass through. But in any case, this was the finale, the last fanfare, the closure that had been sought and denied for 20 years, for both the musicians and the fans. This was the greatest farewell in rock history, since the band said goodbye at the last waltz, and that concert took place before a mere 5,000 people, not hundreds of thousands, not only in Chicago, but watching the pay-per-view video feed across the country. The entire nation took note of the final concert by the Grateful Dead, from the highest offices in the land on down. President Obama paid tribute in a statement released by the White House, which Shapiro reprinted in the program for the day's concert. Here's to 50 years of the Grateful Dead, an iconic American band that embodies the creativity, passion, and ability to bring people together that makes America so great, Obama wrote. Enjoy this weekend celebration of your fans and legacy. And as Jerry would say, let there be songs to fill the air. Lesh, Weir, Hart, and Kreutzmann would take the stage together for the last time in their lives. The four musicians constituted one of the greatest and most original rhythm sections ever. Without Garcia at the center, their gyroscope had wobbled for 20 years, writing just long enough to pull off this extraordinary coup of a finale. Whatever personal problems had plagued them would now be put aside for the music one last time. They owed this to the fans, and themselves. This was anything but just another gig. They needed to be at their finest hour. Their emotions ran high as they took the stage with serious looks of intent on their faces. Cameron Sears had a car waiting for his wife and family at the airport that morning, and she rushed them to the concert, walking in backstage almost at showtime. Cassidy Sears immediately saw Trixie Garcia, with whom she had grown up backstage, and another Dead kid friend, Sage Scully, the daughter of the band's first manager, Rock Scully, who had died only the previous January. She was instantly caught up in the flush of the happy family reunion, besieged by dear old friends she hadn't seen in years, but couldn't stay backstage and catch up because the band was about to start. She hurriedly made her way out into the crowd, getting into place as the band began to play. As soon as they struck up the music, she burst into tears and bawled through the entire first song. She was not the only one weeping in the crowd. Today, as they went on stage, Lesh summoned everyone to the center to take a bow. The seven acknowledged the crowd, both in front and behind, and basked in the prolonged reception, finally falling into a group hug before taking their places and picking up their instruments. The opening song, China Cat, had been paired practically since its 1968 introduction with I Know You Rider, a number in the songbook from the band's earliest days. Anastasio took the Garcia vocal on China Cat, and the band roared through a lively jam that quickly segued into the inevitable I Know You Rider, although the musicians stayed on the appealing groove for a long time before Weir stepped forward to sing. The entire stadium sang along. I Know You Rider gonna miss me when I'm gone. Weir took Estimated Profit, his great song from Terrapin Station, at a lazy gait over the reggae beat. The song might have fit more comfortably on the second night set list at Levi's, but Weir gave the song a strong and passionate reading. Anastasio vamped on Garcia's envelope filter part through a lengthy, heated instrumental passage before the band migrated into a spacey jam that brought the song to a close. Hornsby pulled out the surprising Built to Last title song of the Dead's final album that the band played a handful of times in 1990, and then discarded, only to have Lesh reprise the number with both fill-in friends and further. Hunter's lyrics were weirdly appropriate. All the stars are gone but one. Morning breaks, here comes the sun. Cross the sky, sinking fast. Show me something built to last. Samson and Delilah was one of the songs Weir used to bring down the walls at Winterland. He can command the old blues song with the authority of a Viking. At Chicago, he snapped the house to full attention every time he stepped to the mic on a song the band traditionally saved for Sundays. Lesh sang Mountains of the Moon, a piece from Oxymoxoa the Dead played a few times over a couple of months in 1969, which was primarily a vehicle for a long, spacey jam that gave way to Weir singing a lusty Throwing Stones. The instrumental passage built to a driving climax, Weir and Anastasio locking together for a piercing, stinging fusillade that had the crowd waving their arms and dancing. With that, the band broke for intermission. Fireworks covered the sky at the end of the set break. As starbursts exploded above them, the band filed on stage to watch. Jill Lesh held Baby Levon, wearing protective earphones, in her arms, pointing to the skies. As the last streaks of fireworks disappeared from the sky, the band rumbled into Truckin'. Unlike the version they played in Santa Clara, the band nailed it hard this time. Vocal harmonies on the mark, band pumped up, Comenti's organ finally fully in the mix, streaming down the groove at a crunching tempo. Anastasio lit up a stinging, piercing guitar solo. The whole band came out on fire. They stretched the song past the 10-minute mark. Weir sang his song, Cassidy, with his most earnest conviction, the band wrapping around him and lifting him up as he sang, then pouring themselves into a long, fiery jam. In the crowd, Cassidy Sears burst into tears again. It was her birthday song, and was also steeped in close personal associations for Weir. He had sung the song several hundred times, but never with any more feeling than he did in Chicago. Anastasio stood up next to sing Althea. He had expected the song to show up on the first set list, and when it didn't, assumed the number was being dropped entirely. He was somewhat relieved not to have to perform this particular Garcia vocal in front of a million deadheads, especially after watching Weir and Lesh battle over the song's tempo the day before at soundcheck. He drew a breath, stepped forward, and, having seen Garcia play this song from the audience 1,000 times, counted off the song at the proper tempo while staring Weir straight in the eye. Behind him, the band slammed into the song, and he turned and delivered his best vocal performance yet, his confidence having grown immensely, seemingly overnight. The band took off on another soaring excursion that led away to the opening notes of the Terrapin Station Suite, one of the most complex and delicate compositions in the Dead repertoire, where they hit the first speed bump of the set, Lesh's vocals on Lady with a Fan. People had tried to persuade Lesh not to attempt this vocal, but he insisted. There had been years in the 80s when Lesh didn't sing with the band, and the crew didn't even set up a mic stand for him. Lesh's voice lacks the range and power for truly expressive singing. He labored carefully over the lyrics, rolling on and off pitch, in a voice that was, for the most part, bland and colorless. He couldn't articulate the melody with any precision. He approached the lyrics tentatively and swallowed his consonants. With his stiff delivery and limited skills, he left little room for nuance. And play what you want, a band is only as good as the singer. When Weir took the mic for the main body of the song, the difference was instantly apparent. Weir sang his heart out, crafting each line with supple care. Even the drum solo by Kreutzmann and Hart was supercharged, the two drummers stirring up a storm of high-powered rhythms on their drum kits before Hart moved to his sequencers, sonifications, and the beam, the strange giant percussion instrument of his own devising, he once described as doorbells from Mars. Using a driving, rhythmic loop, Hart dropped dancing, swimming, flying sparks over the beats. Kreutzmann retreated from his stool and joined in the crazy assortment of percussion instruments and drums arrayed on the stage in the cage-like assemblage known as the Beast. Hart even dragged out the train horns he used to blast out 25 years before to announce Casey Jones at Dead shows. He got on the beam and led the reconvened ensemble in a dazzling fog of noises and sonic inventions that paved the approach brilliantly to the ending reprise of Terrapin Station. Lesh, once again, alas, on vocals. A stunning, mesmerizing jam where the sound mix and band arrangement finally put Hornsby's piano playing in the foreground gave way to Unbroken Chain, a Lesh song introduced to the band's repertoire in the final months before Garcia died. Lesh adopted the song not only as the name of his charity, but as a kind of signature number with Phil and Friends and further that his fans rallied around. Weir followed with the emotional high point of the show, a wrenching version of Days Between, which the band gave a magnificent, epic 13-minute performance. The song, probably the last Garcia Hunter masterpiece, introduced by the band in 1992, was a melancholic Hunter ruminating over the past. And there were days, I know, when all we ever wanted was to learn and love and grow. The bittersweet mood of the song, whatever is the opposite of nostalgia or a fond feeling for the past, perfectly underscored the moment. The song was autobiography as Weir was singing it. He delivered the sermon with surgical precision and gospel intensity. He was nothing short of amazing. He seized the moment with every ounce of his abilities, his blazing eyes staring intently into the night. As the last note of Days Between hung in the air, inviting a solemnity to the proceedings, the drummers began to pound out a familiar jungle tattoo. Bump-de-bump, de-bump, bump-bump. The call of the introduction to Not Fade Away. The song's original author, Buddy Holly, borrowed Bo Diddley's beat, and the Rolling Stones compressed his plaintive plea into a tidy rocking beat. But the Dead found the spiritual center of the song and opened it up long ago into a broad, rollicking tribute to everlasting spirit. In the hands of the Dead, the song was no longer about trivial romantic affections. It took on cosmic dimensions. Never did the song make more sense for the band. Never was the message more appropriate. And, for once, Weir set the tempo at a strong, stirring, almost martial upbeat. Off at a gallop, this one he would not slow down. He turned to the crowd and stroked the loud, stinging chords that announced the first verse, and, in that instant, pulled the crowd together as one. The three vocalists stepped to their mics and sang. At the end, as the band faded the song on stage, the audience took it over, clapping the beat behind the singers as the musicians slowly stopped playing, then taking over the singing when they stopped. The drummers jammed with the crowd, adding the beats between the crowd singing, "You know our love will not fade away." Eventually, they also stopped and left the stage. But the crowd did not stop. They kept singing, clapping between the lines themselves to keep the beat now. They sang loud and lusty, an entire stadium full of people, and they didn't stop until Lesh reemerged from backstage. An obviously moved Lesh came out to deliver his donor rap. "Now, we've arrived at the point," he said. "We never thought we would get here. I'd like to think of it as a crossroads rather than an ending. I know everybody here is going to walk out tonight and move on with their lives, and hopefully, as am I, energized by all the love we've seen in these shows. God bless you. I mean that. We're going to do that. Take some tangents, move in different directions. It's been a long time coming, but I'm grateful for it." He made his standard plea for the audience to pledge to become organ donors. "Long live Terrapin Nation," he said. The crowd again picked up the chant, "You know our love won't fade away." Weir emerged from backstage wearing a t-shirt reading, "Let Trey Sing," and started snapping off the chords to the introduction for the final song as Anastasio, a huge smile spread across his face, stepped forward to sing Touch of Grey. Hornsby handled the second verse, Then Weir took over and sang the rest of the song. Photos of the band in their youth splashed on the video screen as their lives flashed before their eyes. This was it, the last Grateful Dead song at the last Grateful Dead concert. Weir made the most of it. Lesh always planned to end the concerts with the angelic chorale, Addicts of My Life. It would have been much better if they had taken the time to rehearse the difficult three-part harmonies. Anastasio kept wanting to try out the song in San Rafael, but they only ran it once around a piano. The next time they tried the song, everybody had forgotten their parts, and nobody was singing the Garcia part. They ran the song a couple of times in soundchecks, but Anastasio was panicked. He called his New York arranger, Jeff Tansky, and asked him to write charts based on the record. He handed charts to Hornsby and kept one for himself. While a montage of old photos of the band members, living and dead, paraded across the stadium video screens, Weir led the vocal ensemble on acoustic guitar. Chimenti eased in a little organ and sang the melody from his charts. Nobody came in together crisply, and the timing, breathing, and pitch varied through the first verse as the little choral group picked up steam. They finally caught up with each other in time for the final crescendo and put the song and the concert and the Grateful Dead to rest. Lesh summoned the band to center stage for their bow. He and Weir hugged and kissed. Hearts slipped under Lesh's other arm as the entire ensemble took their bow. The musicians stood on the stage, talking and hugging, culminating in a giant group hug, broken up by a cheer. The audience picked up the not fade away clapping again. That left it to Mickey Hart to offer the benediction. On his way off the stage, he stopped at the microphone. "Please, the feelings we have here," he said. "Remember them. Take them home. Do some good. Hug your husband, your wife, your kids. I leave you with this. Please be kind." If the entire series at Levi's Stadium began with a rainbow, this was the pot of gold at the end. It was a triumph. The closing set had been everything it needed to be, everything it should have been, everything everybody wanted it to be. It was rich with emotion, hot licks, imaginative improvisations, inspiration, some great singing, and most of all, the magnificent songs of Jerry Garcia and Robert Hunter, whose name was not mentioned from stage once during all five concerts. Hunter didn't mind. Hunter knew how unsentimental those guys were. He didn't attend the concerts anyway. Despite everything, the musicians had succeeded. Perhaps in the final set, they at last did what they came to do. They managed to evoke the mystery, the magic, the adventure of a Grateful Dead concert as well as anyone since the Grateful Dead. Backstage after the show, Jonathan Levine painfully made his way to Lesh's dressing room. The booking agent, who had been such an important part of the Phil Lesh solo career, had undergone major spinal surgery 6 weeks before, and he was only able to walk with a great deal of difficulty. He had received a note from Jill inviting him to the Santa Clara shows, but those were out of the question. He managed to pull himself together the next week and fly from Nashville for the final show in Chicago. 20 years before, he had been changing planes at Chicago's Midway Airport when the Grateful Dead gave their last show at Soldier Field, and he briefly considered deplaning and going to the show before deciding to continue his flight. He didn't feel he could miss it this time. In the spacious dressing room in the bowels of the stadium, alone with the Leshes after the show, Levine joined a sentimental champagne toast with Jill and Phil. They were soaking in the glow of this immense accomplishment. They were happy and spent. Levine left them alone, and when he couldn't find a ride back to his nearby hotel, made the excruciatingly slow and painful walk back by himself. Back at the hotel, Trixie Garcia found herself partying with members of the band, Bill Walton, and other insiders in the lobby of the Ritz-Carlton. Everyone was there, except the Leshes and Weir. It had been a draining series of concerts for Jerry's youngest daughter. All five shows had been like a whirlwind. She had been continually swamped by old friends and deadheads. She gave dozens of interviews. Growing up backstage at Grateful Dead shows, she knew the difference between the band and Fare Thee Well, but she enjoyed the music enough. Mostly, she was connecting dots and looking for some closure of her own. She had spent a lot of time with her two sisters and her mother, and she was bone tired. But she was wondering where Weir was when he swooped down on her and carried her away to his own party in his suite. This was the real after-party. Weir's hotel room was crowded with freaks and characters. The atmosphere was loose and celebratory. Weir was relaxed, feeling good, and holding court. Trixie felt right at home. People were drinking and sharing joints. Everybody was still high from the concert. Movie star Bill Murray rampaged around the room, in a festive mood after staying late to help the grounds crew clean up the trash. 50 years later, that's the way it was. Chapter 24. Coda. Fare Thee Well was an outsized, unprecedented success by almost any measure. The shows drew more than $50 million at the box office, a record for a concert by a single band. Total attendance was more than 362,000. For the third day in a row, the Last Soldier Field concert broke the long-standing attendance record held by U2 with a crowd of 71,000. The band sold $8 million worth of t-shirts and hoodies at the five shows. One concertgoer paid $526,000 in a charity auction over the weekend for a signed guitar Bobby Weir played for a couple of numbers at Levi's Stadium. The pay-per-view broadcast also set a record for a music broadcast, with 175,000 streams subscribed. Over the 4th of July weekend, the entire nation knew the Grateful Dead was playing the band's final concerts in Chicago. Clubs and theaters all over the country hosted events. Peter Shapiro had crowds every night at both his Brooklyn Bowl and Capitol Theater. Both the Sweetwater and Terrapin Crossroads held viewings. Even the Empire State Building got in the act, draping its top floors and spire in red, white, and blue lights to celebrate the show in Chicago. Given the men from the Dead had no idea what to expect from the event, the reception was breathtaking. They floated out of Chicago on a cloud. The reviews treated the musical performances fairly. John Pareles, the distinguished pop music critic of the New York Times, wrote a review of all three concerts. "Fare Thee Well, celebrating 50 years of the Grateful Dead," he wrote, "also revived the band as an enterprise, both quixotic and commercial, history-minded and fond of a tall tale, carefully plotted and forever in search of the happy accident. This briefly convened, decisively final incarnation of the Grateful Dead often managed to live up to the band's name with songs that could turn intuitive, down-home, whimsical, haunted, elegant, or euphoric." Greg Cott of the Chicago Tribune was less certain. "Without Garcia, this couldn't be the Grateful Dead anymore, no matter what the ticket stub says. Instead, this was, at best, a Grateful Dead tribute show, a celebration of a remarkable legacy," said Cott. Writing in England's The Guardian, Mark Guarino was more reasoned. "Expecting the original band would be naive," Guarino wrote. "Instead, the band that showed up this weekend ignited fresh sparks and induced a few lulls, both with well-intended reverence for the back catalog that has remained poignant." Perhaps the most remarkable thing about the shows in Chicago was that the seventh member showed up. In the early days of the Grateful Dead, the band would speak of that intangible extra ingredient that made a show great as the seventh member. Sometimes he would be there at the beginning of a show and leave. Sometimes he would show up in the middle and stay. Sometimes he wouldn't come. He could not be depended on in any way, But when he was there, the gigs were great. The seventh member always brought the party. At Levi Stadium, the seventh member flitted in and out of the shows. At Chicago, he made longer appearances in the first two shows, but never settled into his chair. On the final show, he played several numbers with the band during the first set and decided to stay for the rest of the night. The result was that the last set of the last show was on fire, infused with a secret ingredient that was the primary drug of the Deadheads. Whatever absolution the Fare Thee Well band needed, they more than earned in the 10th set of the 5-concert run. With that final pinnacle, they had done what they came to do. And, as only the Grateful Dead could do, they chose to honor their legacy with this extraordinary panoramic retrospective of their glorious career. 10 sets, 88 songs, a mere 2 repeats, more than 17 hours on stage. They could have played Wagner's complete Ring cycle in that time. The grand ambition it required is something that goes to the heart of the Grateful Dead. The band that went to Egypt to play the Great Pyramids. The band that built the Wall of Sound. The band whose manager once posted plans for a flying amphitheater on his office wall. Any rock band could have simply put together one set of greatest hits and played it 5 times. But the Grateful Dead were always more than just another rock band. All of this was nothing short of a miracle. A miracle worked in no small part by Peter Shapiro, a true believer innocent enough to think he could make this happen. Shapiro never lost touch with his fan side. He was one of the crowd and ably represented their audience's point of view to band members. In the entire music business, only Shapiro was positioned to be able to navigate the thorny, twisting, slippery back channels of the Grateful Dead world to bring the fractured group back together just long enough to play these concerts. He alone also knew how successful this reunion would be. Even more so than the band, Shapiro understood the vast musical and social subculture based on Grateful Dead music that had developed over the years since Garcia's death. Fare Thee Well certainly qualified as a peak, but Shapiro's vision extended into the future. Immediately after the concerts, he announced appearances by all 4 members of the Dead Men at his lock-in festival in September. Phil and Friends would be joined by guitarist Carlos Santana. Kreutzmann would bring his latest ensemble, Billy and the Kids, and Hart would perform 3 times, including 2 late-night concerts in the woods with Steve Kamok. Bob Weir would serve as special guest, sitting in all day with whoever would have him, and many would. Shapiro was in the Grateful Dead business, and business was never better. In August, Weir, Hart, Kreutzmann, and John Mayer announced the Halloween debut performance by Dead & Company in Madison Square Garden. Ironically, Lesh would be playing for Shapiro an hour's drive away at the Capitol Theater. Oteil Burbidge from the Allman Brothers would play bass, and Chimenti would handle keyboards. Fare Thee Well's impact on everyone involved, the boys of the band, the community of Deadheads, the culture at large, and even their own music, was multi-layered and profound. The event was freighted with so much meaning to so many people for so many reasons, resonating far beyond the pariahical world of the Deadheads. In some ways, Fare Thee Well was an echo of Woodstock, 46 years later, a fresh reminder that the ideals represented there would not disappear, no matter how much they had been marginalized, dissolved, derided, and plain laughed off. The same spirit attended both events. The crowds came together in peace and love for the music and understood that for however long they would be together, they had become a community. In the 21st century, the Grateful Dead were one of the last remnants, the final rallying points of 60s idealism, long thought to have vanished. The impressive display of community made clear that whatever it was that people called the movement, the underground, the counterculture, Woodstock Nation, or any other name, whose values had not only never vanished, They now permeated all ranks and ages of American society. Yet they still stood outside the mainstream, an alternative to the evanescent pop and R&B conventions of the day. The flame was not extinguished. It had many keepers, a silent tribe whose clarion call to assemble one last time